You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
America, Israel, and the Middle East by Alain Journeau.
I thought we'd start with some common ground. Something that on this topic, practically everyone will agree on. This is what most people's view of the Middle East is. And I don't just mean the people who work in Washington, D.C. I mean most people. Now, this is partly satirical. If you follow the lines, it's really not going to make more sense to you if you know the region. I've tried it. I wanted to share this with you because this went around the internet a few years ago. There's something to this. It is really complicated. What caught my eye and the reason I selected this is this portion right here. Note, this diagram omits the topic that I've written a book about. Palestine and Israel were discounted for the sake of simplicity. Well, I appreciate that because now I have an opportunity to write a book. But seriously, it is really complicated. And it's a lot of people think it's unsolvable. And here's a statement. Whom the gods would destroy, they first tempt to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, this is a statement from someone whom I disagree with, but I think there's some truth in this. The basic message I take from this is a lot of attempts have been made to bring some peace to this, some order, some maybe harmony, I don't know. And every attempt, really every attempt, has failed. So you basically have to be crazy to try this. It hasn't stopped people, but they keep trying. So it's complicated, it seems unresolvable, and add to this, there's still another layer of disagreement or conflict over the conflict, if you will. And that is, people disagree about this question. What's at stake? So you could have the view that it's complicated, yeah, but who cares, right? Or you could have a range of any other views, like it's complicated, but it matters a lot, it matters in this way, it matters in that. But this makes it even more difficult to make sense of. So this is what I set myself as an assignment. I wanted to answer these questions. I wanted to answer what's at stake, what's really going on, and what are America's actual interests in this part of the world, and with respect to the Israel-Palestine conflict in particular. I wrote this book. You might have heard about it. Thank you. But let me quote to you something a friend of mine told me or said to me very frankly when I told him about this book. He said, well, who needs another book on this subject? What are you bothering with? Well, what's wrong with you, basically? He used more colorful language. So I want to make the case that there is a need for this kind of book that answers the question of what's at stake, what's the essential nature of this conflict, and what is a path to a better future. And to make that case, I want to just highlight today what I think is the source of the book's value, what makes it interesting and useful and worth reading and I think enlightening. And it's important that you get this particular point. This is not a history book. It's not a play-by-play account of what happened. There is some history. It's not a political analysis. Those are not the ways in which the book stands out. There are really good books on all of those topics. There is a gap, however, that the book is attempting to fill, an intellectual void, and that is offering a perspective that is informed by a rational philosophic perspective. And that's what I think makes this book really distinctive. And there are two aspects that I want to indicate, and I'll flesh them out in a little more detail. The two aspects of this philosophic perspective are these. One, I bring a distinctive value framework. So the book's orientation, the kind of perspective it takes, is that the life of the individual matters. It's an individualist perspective, not a tribal, not a collectivist one. And as you might have guessed, if you know something about this part of the world, that's unusual, both in terms of the way people think in that part of the world and the way their advocates and proponents view the world. So it's an individualist book. Moreover, it's a secular book. it takes this world seriously, and there is no other world as far as I'm concerned. It's this world that counts. It's a secular individualist perspective. And more than that, I think what follows from this from a political perspective is that if you value the life of the individual, the kind of society you should aspire to, you should hold up as an ideal, is one that leaves individuals free. So it's a secular individualist pro-freedom book. That's sort of the value orientation I bring to it. The second aspect of the philosophic perspective that's distinctive here is that what I set myself as a task to do is to understand the essentials of the conflict, both factually and morally. Now that might seem like an obvious kind of straightforward assignment. It was really hard, and I think I've got it. You can judge for yourself if you pick up a copy of the book. That's the point I want to illustrate, that so much of what has gone wrong in this conflict in terms of people's attempt to understand it, to solve it, to explain it to other people, is that there's been a failure to get at what's essential to it, what makes it stand out, and the fundamental causes, the fundamental drivers of what's pushing it forward, what's kept it going, if you will. And to illustrate that, I want to look at that question that I put on the screen, what's at stake, and give you two different views of that, two different perspectives of what's at stake. And in doing so, I'm going to show you how these views go wrong. Now, some people, when you tell them that, they're expecting a hammer to come out and the hammer to drop. I'm not trying to refute these views. What I want to show that there's plausibility to them. And that's part of why they've been influential. But they don't get at the whole truth. They don't get at the essentials of the issue. And that's what I want to draw out. So you'll see there's evidence for what I'm going to show you in terms of these two views. But they don't really get at the issue, basically. So the first view I want to talk about is something you might have heard. Sometimes it's put in the form of objection. I've definitely heard it in the form of objection. It's basically this. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular is one of many, 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 many conflicts in that part of the world. And it's about land. There's two groups of people, two tribes, sometimes it's put that way, and they're fighting over a piece of land. And the implication that often follows from that is, well, who cares? Like, let them fight it out. I mean, there are lots of people in all sorts of parts of the world who are fighting over land. Let them fight it out. What difference is it going to make to you and me, right? And to people across North America and Western Europe and other parts of the world? It's about the land, right? Now, this is not a completely wrong view in the sense that, is there a piece of land that people are fighting over? Yes, that's clearly true. If you ask the people, what is it that they want some land. That's not a hard thing to validate. But that gets you only so far. It gets you just to the superficial level, sort of the surface level. What's really going on here? And I think a way to get at that, and a way to show that that view is incomplete, that it doesn't get at the essentials, is to ask this question. Well, what would you do with the land when you got it? And it's like that story of the dogs chasing the car. Well, what would you do when you got the car, right? It's a real question. And obviously, the dog is not in a position to answer that question. But we should be in a position to ask that question. That question, what would you do with the land, you can frame in terms of a philosophic question. It's a moral, political question. And that is basically the subject matter of political philosophies. What kind of society is good? And you should be able to evaluate that. So I want to ask that question. What would each side do with the land if they got it? Or if they have it, how have they used it? What would they do with it? And here, the framework that I'm using is, well, again, it's an individualist perspective. It's, if you lived in this place, would you want to live there? Or would you try to do the best you can to flee for the sake of your life? Like, think of it from the perspective, it's my life, I have one life to live. I want to live in a society that's compatible with my ability to thrive and flourish. So that's the value orientation. Let's look at this view. So I've said, yes, it's plausible that this is about land. The adversaries are talking about it, that's what they want. How are they going to use it? What would they do? Well, let's start with, we're going to look at Israel on one side, and we're going to look at its current adversary on the other side. So let's start with Israel first. Now, I don't think the issue is over land. I don't think that's the primary. I think the real issue is freedom versus tyranny. And I'm going to illustrate that by showing you that on one side of this conflict is a basically free society. On the other side, there are movements and regimes that are on the premise of subjugating people. So Israel is a political and economic outlier. And I mean that in the sense, in the region where it exists, it stands out. Politically, unlike other countries in that part of the world, if you live there, you have the freedom of speech. You can change the government peacefully through elections. They actually are representative government. You have the freedom of religion, whatever religion you have, or if you don't have religion, which happens to be common. Very few Israelis I know are actually religious. So it has the kind of political and government institutions that are necessary for a free society, that are necessary for individuals to be able to live and pursue their goals. Now, how many of you are from North America or from Western Europe, by show of hands? Yeah. Okay. Most of us take that for granted. Most people outside this room take that for granted. But those are real achievements politically. And they're even more significant when you consider the alternative just across the border from Israel and various of the countries nearby, which don't have the freedom of speech. They don't have representative government. They actually are some form of tyranny, authoritarianism, monarchy, theocracy. Now, the consequence of having political freedom is that it enables people to flourish economically. And I think I want to give you just a few data points on that to underscore the point that freedom really is important. And if you have a society that's built on that principle, it's valuable. And it's valuable in terms of if you care about human life, this is what you should care about. So here are a few illustrations of the relationship between freedom and prosperity, or freedom and thriving. Israel is sometimes nicknamed the startup nation. It has a very high concentration of high-tech and life sciences startup companies. Now, most startups fail, but it has a lot of startups. It has, I think if you look at the NASDAQ stock exchange, it has the number one country with companies listed is the US, the second is China, and the third is Israel. That's a very high concentration. Now, not everyone works at a startup, but it's telling that this is a distinctive characteristic of this place that they have so many people invested in starting new enterprises and pushing the frontiers of knowledge. But what about everyone else in the society? I'm going to have a lot of graphs. No, seriously, just a couple. Scientific and technical papers is one metric that the World Bank keeps track of. Longer bars are better. That's the short story here. And you can see that Israel is alongside the United Kingdom and the US. And this is just one way of measuring scientific and technical advancement, progress. Now, I'm not vouching for every article that is calculated here. These are numbers in per capita that I calculated. The point is that this is a remarkable achievement for a country to be this productive of new knowledge. Let's give a couple more data points. Now, this is one of the classic measures of human progress. Infant mortality per 1,000. Shorter lines are better. Okay. Notice the big step up here in Saudi Arabia and the countries above it, Libya, Iran, Egypt. That's scary. This is a sidebar, but I think it's worth mentioning. I included Libya alongside Saudi Arabia. They're basically at the same point in terms of infant mortality. What comes to mind when you think of Saudi Arabia? Oil, petrodollars, lots and lots of money sloshing around in the palaces. It turns out that it's basically the royal family that's mostly wealthy. Everyone else is living at Libya levels of infant mortality. Libya, on the other hand, is not nearly as wealthy. Libya has been for a while an anarchical society. Some people would call it a failed state or a failing state, which to me is an indictment of the kind of society that they have in Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Egypt, which are really horrifying in terms of their backwardness on this measure. One more measure, and then there are no more graphs, I promise. Life expectancy at birth, another classic benchmark. Longer bars are better here. France, Israel, UK are sort of on par along with Germany. Notice again the big step down when you get to Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. You don't need to memorize these. There's no quiz. The point is to give you some data to illustrate the point that freedom makes prosperity possible. It makes human life better. And in Israel, it has, for many people, made life way better than it is in neighboring countries. So this is the character of Israel on the one side of this conflict. It is a basically free society. It has a lot of flaws, a lot of failings, a lot of moral shortcomings, moral mistakes, and I talk about these in depth in the book, and you can ask me about them. But the way to think of it, I think, is like a lot of what we would describe free countries around the world, its dominant feature is freedom, even if there are economic controls and serious problems culturally. And I don't mean to make light of those, but even with those problems, it stands head and shoulders above its neighbors. And it's alongside, it's in the league of most of the world's most advanced, scientifically advanced societies. Okay, who's on the other side of this conflict? That's a hard question for most people to answer, because the conflict has had different, Israel has had different adversaries at different times over the last 70 plus years. In the book, I kind of go through the history of the conflict over that period and indicate who those actors and adversaries have been. I'm not going to give you that whole survey here, but I'm going to take the time slice of the last 20 years. And the major adversary Israel has faced over the last 20 years is the Islamist movement in the form of Hamas and Hezbollah. Hamas is the Islamic resistance movement in Palestine. Hezbollah is in Lebanon, and behind them, one of their major patrons is the Iranian regime, which has ambitions to dominate the whole Middle East. Now, I put this on the slide, variations on a theme of religious subjugation, because although my focus is just on Hamas and the Islamist adversaries today, if you go back, as I argue, in time, that is the dominant feature of Israel's adversaries. They have been seeking to use the land to expand their authoritarian or dictatorial rule. I've kind of given away the story. What is Hamas going to do with the land that it has, right? What is the Palestinian movement, which is divided, and Hamas is just one component of it? Let's take a step back. The Palestinian movement is a mess. It has various factions in it, but the two leading ones are quasi-secular dictators without a state, seeking land to dominate, and then the jihadists of Hamas. In both cases, what they've demonstrated is that to the extent they've gained control of territory, of land, right? So think about this argument that this is just about land. To the extent they've gained control of any territory with people on it, the dictators have created a dictatorship, and the Islamists have created a totalitarian jihadist type regime where they've attempted to Islamize people's lives in as many ways as they can. That's really the conflict here. Land matters, but it's what people would do with the land. It's the ideas that they would put into practice on the land that they would control. That's what's at stake here. This is the slogan that you find, one of the many statements in Hamas's covenant, which is its founding document. This is where the conflict really lies. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. That's what they are arguing. That's how they rally people. That is the face of the adversary. So this is a very short account of, we have a basically free society on one side, and on the other side we have what has become, what has been led by a jihadist group, Hamas, backed by a really ambitious regime in Iran that has the same kind of ideology. Iran, you might know if you've been following the news, one of the latest developments is Iran is now creating bases in Syria as part of the Syrian civil war. And part of their reason for that is that they can't leave this job just to Hamas, right? They think that they themselves might need to launch a war eventually. So it's just a way to illustrate that this really is a conflict between freedom and tyranny. I mean, if you really dig down to the essentials of it, what are the ideas actuating this conflict? I want to talk about the other kind of view of what's at stake here. It's the core issue. Now, this is a statement that you can hear from various sources. This particular one is from King Abdullah II of Jordan. He made a speech many years ago. He's not the only one to hold this view. And there are variations of it. I'm just going to pick one of them today. What do they mean by this? Well, here, the answer to what's at stake is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the core issue. It is the source of regional strife and upheaval and war. It has spillover effects. It drives all the instability. It drives people to fight each other and kill. And in a certain way, people will put it this way. They will explain it like this. Look, if you want to understand why that big spaghetti diagram at the beginning is the way it is, you got to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because it is sort of the wellspring of all that chaos. So it's like it's a causal argument about what's driving the Middle East more broadly into its paroxysms of war and civil war and interstate war and tribal conflicts. So get it? So it's a causal argument that if you put it sort of in the negative, if only you could solve this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, then all these other things would solve themselves or become less issues. The region would become really stable, or much more stable, right? Is there any merit to this? What to make of this argument? Well, is it the source of regional strife? I think there is a case to be made for this, right? If you count the number of wars that have involved Israel since its existence, I think by one reckoning you can make it five major wars. Okay? That's significant. Five is nothing to, that's a big deal. But that doesn't really answer the question, is it the fundamental driver of conflict in the region? We saw a big, messy diagram, right? And I think it's not completely wrong. Well, let's look at a few wars that have occurred during that same period and ask, were they fueled, were they triggered by Israel and the Palestinian conflict? So how many people here are old enough, I wouldn't put it how many are old enough to remember, but how many people are aware of the war that occurred in the 1980s between Iran and Iraq, by a show of hands? Good. Many of you have heard of it. For those who haven't heard, it lasted about 8 years. This is when Iraq was ruled by Saddam Hussein and Iran was ruled by the Ayatollah Khomeini. This is one of the most brutal wars in recent memory. I happened to do some research on it. The kind of tactics that were used on the battlefield. I mean, think child soldiers, really horrific kind of things. Now, it was also one of the most deadly conflicts in terms of human life, human toll. I think around 1 million people died in this conflict. How much of this conflict was triggered by, caused by, fueled by some causal relationship between this conflict and the Israel-Palestinian conflict? By a show of hands, like 50%? 75%? Let's go down. 25%. None of you are buying it. Okay. Okay, good. It is zero, right? It had zero to do with it. And that's significant, because if you look at one of the major clashes in this part of the world in the recent memory, zero to do with it. We'll take another example. Something much more recent. The Syria conflict, right? It starts with protesters in 2012, I think, 2011, as part of the Arab Spring, and it becomes a civil war, and it becomes many other things. It becomes a clash between Iran and other countries. It becomes a jihadist uprising, and ISIS gets to be part of this, and it really is a mess, right? It is also one of the worst conflicts we've seen recently in terms of the kinds of weapons used and the number of people displaced and set off away from their homes just to avoid being caught in the crossfire in terms of refugees around the world. Again, I'm not going to ask you because I'm getting the sense that you're kind of on this wavelength, but it has zero to do with the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and that's significant, right? So if you look at one of the most recent clashes, the Israel-Palestinian conflict doesn't account for it in any causal way. So although the number of conflicts involving Israel is significant, I think I said it was five, there are many you can find in the past and recent ones that have nothing to do with it. How many how many are there that have nothing to do with it? Well, the region really is racked by war. And by one reckoning, there have been 20 conflicts, independent of those two that I mentioned just now, that have nothing to do causally with the Israel-Palestinian conflict. So it's not an account that it gets at the fundamental drivers of the Middle East to say, well, let's point at this conflict over here, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, to account for this whole sweep of other kinds of clashes. It doesn't really get at the essentials of it. So I don't think it's a source of regional strife. I don't think that accounts for it at all. But what would be an account? How are we to make sense of the Middle East and all these conflicts? I think you have to look at something deeper than just a blaming of one conflict for all the others. I think it really is ideas driven. I'll give you a flavor of that. The Gulf War, remember, do you guys remember the first Gulf War in the 1990s? Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. Why does he invade Kuwait? Because he wants to take Kuwaiti oil. This is a dictator doing what dictators do. He actually tried to take over the country, and this is driven by the kind of mentality of a dictator. It's a kind of pathology, right? But it's justified in terms of certain ideas, like the glory of the Iraq or the Arab people. Another kind of driver is what we saw in Syria, what we're seeing in Syria, which is tribal and sectarian fighting. The group comes first. We have to dominate. Those people are heretics. We're the true believers. Or that tribe, they're disgusting. They're beneath human, right? Another kind of idea that drives people to take up arms and kill each other. And broadly, the idea of collectivism, the idea that the group comes first, whether it's the religious group, the tribe, the clan, that is a particular idea that drives people. Now, these are irrational ideas, but nevertheless, that is what I think where you need to look to get an account of what's driving so much of the conflict in the region. And the biggest story in terms of the region's upheavals, the biggest story is one particular ideology. And I've already mentioned it. It's the Islamic movement. It's not only Hamas, it's particularly Iran and the other regimes that are aligned with it that are trying to bring Islamic rule wherever they can. ISIS is one example of this. So the region, if you want to look at if there were a core issue, I don't think it's a good way to frame, but if there were a core issue that explains so much of the strife, so much of the fighting, so much of the war making, you need to look at the dominant ideological movement in that part of the world, the jihadist group, movement and the factions that fall under it. So I don't think the account of the what's at stake question here, that what's at stake is this one conflict is a wellspring for the whole region's upheavals. I don't think that really gets to the core of it. It doesn't answer the question of what's at stake. What really is at stake is that there are a lot of people who believe in ideas that are hostile to freedom trying to dominate other people. It really is about ideas at this point. So the point I want to leave you with on this in this discussion of what is driving the region's conflict, it's this, that you can't look at the region and try to account for it, explain it, or make sense of it by grabbing at superficial or surface-level explanations. You need to dig deeper. You need to get at the essentials of what these conflicts are about and what's driving people. Fundamentally, what are the drives? What are the causes of people's actions? And I think it's ideas, primarily. In this case, really, really bad ideas. So I've given you two perspectives on the question of what's at stake. I think neither one gets at the story correctly, right? They get at some of the facts. They try to process it and conceptualize it, but they don't get at the essentials of it factually or morally, and that's what I think is really needed here. Now, I argue that if you want to understand it and you want to make find a path to a better future in this part of the world, what's crucial is that you take one idea very seriously. And that is the principle of freedom. And I mean that in a number of ways. I want to illustrate that and sort of wrap up this discussion of what's at stake. if my analysis is correct and I make a full case for it in the book, what Israel is confronting is a conflict between its society, which is a basically free one, and regimes and movements that are hostile to it and that want to destroy freedom, the freedom of people living in Israel and the people everywhere else in that part of the world, and primarily under religious goals, so the idea of dominating under the banner of Islam. So in thinking about what's at stake, you have to have a principle to guide you. And that's a big part of what's missing in America's foreign policy, which I go into at length. What does it look like to take the idea of freedom seriously? Well, it means to recognize the value of it and to have it shape your actions and your goals and your priorities in understanding the region and then defining actions and policies with respect to it. So one of the things I argue for is that freedom is such a valuable thing and such a rare thing in the world, both in history and in particularly in the Middle East, but also in the modern world. We know how precious it is because we see it in North America and in Western Europe being threatened all the time. We see it being eroded. We see people all the time not understanding its value, which is all the more reason to defend it and explain it and champion it. But I argue that you have to do that as well, not only domestically, but also in terms of your foreign policy, how you engage with the rest of the world. So in this conflict, the main argument I make is that if you have to pick a side, and you have to judge the adversaries. And the standard by which you should judge them is this principle, a universal good. It's good for all people, in all times, in all places. And it should guide your perspective toward it. Now, it doesn't answer every question that comes up, but it guides you in terms of how to answer them. And what I argue for is taking a stand for freedom has at least a few components. One is you stand with the side that actually represents and respects and tries to uphold freedom, in this case, Israel, and you stand with it to the extent that it's free and for as long as it's free. Those are important because if it changes, if it becomes a less free society, you would have to rethink it. It's not an intrinsic commandment, oh, you must stand with Israel. God told you to, right? That's not the point. The point is, if you value this principle and you think human life matters and progress matters, you stand with societies that are free for as long as they're free. But it also means you stand with people elsewhere who are for freedom. And that includes among the Palestinian community, because I think there are some, and includes people elsewhere in the Middle East, and there are definitely people seeking real freedom in that part of the world. And one thing I raise in the book is that, unfortunately, one of the real tragedies of American foreign policy is that, for the most part, it has sold those people out. That is not what it looks like to stand for freedom. So you want to stand with everyone, regardless of their race, regardless of their religion. If they believe in the value of human life and freedom, you should stand with them. And obviously oppose and seek the elimination and try to stop all the forces that are against freedom and call them out and explain that that is what you're doing and recognize them for what they are. Instead of, say, I don't know, hypothetically, going to Saudi Arabia, shaking hands with the king, and then coming home and hosting the crown prince of Saudi Arabia at your house, let's call it the White House, instead of doing those things and never saying a word about the dissidents in Saudi Arabia, the people who are living in prisons because they spoke out for freedom of speech, that is not what it looks like to stand for freedom. And I'm not just picking on Donald Trump, which is what he did with respect to Saudi Arabia. This is the pattern we've seen under Obama. It's the pattern we saw under George Bush. There isn't really a principled commitment to freedom in the Middle East, and that is a huge part of the problem. If you want an aggravating factor, it's the reality that American policy has been unprincipled and has sold out not only free societies in many ways with respect to Israel, has not been as strong an ally as people imagine, but also the people elsewhere seeking freedom. So part of what I want to leave you with is that, you know, remember that chaos diagram I showed you? It's precisely because it's so complicated and so contentious, that's all the more reason that you need principles. You need a principled perspective, and you need to understand issues in terms of their essentials and the fundamental drivers. That's exactly contrary to conventional thinking. Conventional thinking is, it's so complicated. How we ever make sense of this? We could never be consistent. Let's not even bother, right? Let's figure out one issue at a time. That's more the line people take. And my answer to that is, no, that's making it worse. That's making it far worse. So take a principled stand for freedom. Stand with those who are for the kind of values that are the inheritance of the Enlightenment, the idea of individuals being the starting point of politics, that government is the servant, not the master of the individual, and that human life and progress are really, really important and good, and we should foster them and encourage them everywhere we see it. And that's a big part of what's missing in our approach to this part of the world. Well, what would it take to change our approach, to encourage the better people, to support those who deserve it? Well, I think it takes a shift, a really significant mind shift. But it's also essential, it's necessary. There's no shortcut. And in the book, I've argued that this zooming back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think it is solvable. Right? So I disagree with that quote in the sense that you can get to a better place. But it's not easy. It's not something you can do overnight. But a big part of what you would have to do is take values seriously. Really commit to judging the adversaries by an objective standard and reorient yourself to standing with those who are for rational values in that part of the world. And I think a first step to getting there is real clarity on what the conflict is about. And that's what I offer in the book. So I hope you'll take a look at it and explore it.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.